Hey, folks.
Hello.
My name is Ellen Adair.
And I am Eric Gildy.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Yeah.
In an effort to bring the entire Take Me Into the Ballgame project into one feed, we are going to be releasing our old episodes on Pitcher List week by week.
Yes. Enjoy for the first time or revisit an old favorite.
And so now, this is one of them. Hey, folks.
Hello there.
And welcome to Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Take me into the apocalypse. Take me into the brains. Blah, 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 blah.
It sounded to me like there was a vampire in there somewhere.
Blah. I don't know if there are any vampire baseball films.
Oh, that's a real shame.
That could be a hole just waiting for us to, you know, plug in some script that we have not written yet, but maybe we start after this podcast.
It would be hard for vampires because they really couldn't have played baseball until the advent of electric lighting.
It's true. No day games. Yeah.
And no day games for vampires, that's for sure.
Although there is the baseball scene in the first Twilight movie.
Oh, that's true.
Which we could do at some point,
yes.
But let's not go down that road just
golly.
Now.
So, friends, that is Eric Gildy.
Hi.
And my name is Ellen Adair, and we are two actors who decided that we would watch baseball movies and grade them on the 20 to 80 scouting scale used for baseball prospects.
We did indeed make that decision.
We made that decision, and these are the fruits of that decision. I think I've even said that exact phrase on another podcast.
I think so. I think so. We are sowing what we have reaped. Is that right? We're reaping what we've sowed. I'm not much of a farmer, guys. You know,
he's not much of a sower either.
S-O-W or S-E-W.
Yes. You gotta love those homonyms. So
we're really on track already.
We're way on track to discuss this week's film, which, of course, you're on tenterhooks to know what it is because you didn't just read that in the episode description. But our apocalypse and horror-themed repartee is to signify that this week we are discussing the film The Battery.
There ain't no brain and hold my body down. There ain't no brain and hold my body down.
The Battery. Yes, this is a film that came out. This is a film. Good night, everybody. I've done that joke before.
Talk to you next time.
Oh boy, here we go. So yeah, no, this is a 2012 film that was written, directed, and produced by Jeremy Gardner. And he also stars in it. Wow, that is many, many jobs to give oneself, right? In it, he plays a minor league catcher named Ben, and he and his former teammate Mickey, played by Adam Kronheim, who co-produces, wander Connecticut in the aftermath of a zombie apocalypse that seems to have decimated humanity. Mickey listens to music, is generally in denial about the world that they find themselves in, and also just kind of wants to stay put somewhere, whereas Ben is fully immersed in the moment, at once more prepared for their new circumstances, and also kind of more chill about it. The movie sort of follows them in this dynamic as they try to survive in this new world and encounter some folks along the way that it might just be better to steer clear of.
Indeed. Yeah, that's generally the rule in zombie movies.
Yeah.
Like, steer clear of the zombies and you think that you want to find other people, but actually you should probably steer clear of them too.
Yeah, probably a good time to be like a sort of solitary person.
Yeah, exactly.
I always kind of assume that
introverts
in these
thrive in a zombie apocalypse.
Well, exactly. And I always kind of assume that in these worlds like the Walking Dead worlds, the Battery, all of the various Living Dead type situations, all of that, that somewhere in the universe of that film, there are just like introverted people living like perfectly happy, isolated lives that we just like don't see.
Yeah. They just stay in their apartment. Yeah.
Reading a book, sipping some lemonade.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
You do have to go out and forage for canned goods, I guess, but...
Yeah, you'd probably need to have, like, a green thumb also. That'd be helpful.
Yeah, that would probably
You'd have to understand the sowing and reaping dynamic better than myself. So,
or me.
This film was shot for an astonishing $6,000, with all of the money basically going to lodging, food, and props. Lots and lots of favors called in, and, you know, basically Jeremy Gardner got 10 friends to give him $600 each, and in return they got a stake in the film, like 5%, I think. And they shot it in 16 days with their friends, which is why, like, pretty much all of the zombies are just, like, other, like, kind of young people, like, more or less in their age range. And, you know, thankfully, he had a number of talented friends, including Christian Stella, who was the director of photography on this project, and they've gone on to co-direct some things later, Tex Montana Will Survive and After Midnight in particular. And he had become a, like, working food photographer and was in the process of upgrading his camera and was like, well, I'll just get the one that also lets me shoot video. And, like, he shot it using that with very little in the way of, like, rigs, support, anything along those lines. And so we get this kind of little miracle of a film as a result. Like, love it or hate it, and I definitely am on the love end of that spectrum, it's impressive what these people did with so little.
It is astonishingly impressive. I mean, the first thing that I said when I learned, I believe after we had seen the movie, that it cost $6,000 was like, well, somebody had to own a camera.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, renting
a camera.
To quote
the Kool-Aid Man. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. because that in and of itself, even if you were renting a not very good camera and you didn't own it and were renting it, that would easily be $6,000.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I have to assume. I mean,
quoting him again.
For those of you who don't know, $6,000 it's a magical amount of money to make a film on. To make, if you were like, I'm making a 10-minute film in my apartment for $6,000. That would be a magical amount of money.
It'd be hard. Yeah. You would need also to call in favors. You'd need to already have a lot of the stuff just on hand or available to you. And yeah.
It's like the film equivalent of a negative amount of money. Like, to me, when I heard that, it was as magical to me as if it was like, we somehow found $762.43 in the pockets of the cast and crew while filming this movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's, gentle listeners, it's an almost supernatural amount of money to make a film on.
Ooh, yeah, it is. Ooh, very spooky to even think about. And the thing to say about this as well is that it doesn't look particularly cheap. I think it's a pretty well shot. I mean, you could tell it's like a low budget kind of indie film, but it doesn't.
It doesn't look that different from a $150,000 movie.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, that's kind of where things are at with it. Got picked up at some film festivals. It won some awards. And these folks are just still out there making movies. And it's really cool.
Yeah, major props to them. So before we get to the various categories upon which we are going to grade this movie, if you're just joining us for this episode, you need to know about the 20 to 80 scouting scale. Maybe you don't know about it.
We've got to get this out of the way. We can't go on without you knowing about how this works.
Absolutely not. We're not that irresponsible.
What are we, savages?
We're not savages.
The zombie apocalypse hasn't come for real yet.
True. It seems every day like it might be closer, but it's not here yet.
There you go.
So the first thing to know is that 50 is average, but this is a good thing because this is an average major league player. So this is not an average prospect. This is somebody who projects to play every day and be productive at the major league level.
So I'm going to go away from stick-based food from our previous episode and consider can-based food because there's so many canned foods here, yeah. And that can be a tough thing. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that a 50-grade canned food is like canned tomatoes, just because that is like a right down the middle, like you can use them to make something great. They can contribute and be productive to a good dish. They are, to be fair, not necessarily spectacular on their own, but you can make incredible food with them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're a part of the right team, especially.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So in the baseball world, 45, 40, 30, and 20 are progressively less and less good, where 20 is like, this person does not have this skill at all.
Yeah. What do you think for that?
So for me, I do not care for canned tuna at all.
I kind of had canned meat sort of generally.
Right, but specifically canned tuna. Like, if given the choice between eating canned chicken and canned tuna, I would choose canned chicken 10 times out of 10.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with
you
there.
And I feel like of the canned meat, actually, the more, in a way, fake it is, Spam, I think, is maybe a 45.
Yeah, like, Spam might actually be like a 55 for me.
Okay, all right, that very fair. Yeah, for me, I think it's a 45. It is definitely better than those other things. I feel like canned chicken is maybe a 40, and canned tuna is a 30 for me. I know some people love canned tuna.
No, I think it is for me, too. I just can't get past that smell. It's gross.
Yeah.
But also, towards the bottom are, for me, a lot of canned vegetables, like canned peas, are pretty much the bottom for me.
I have a secret love of canned peas.
What?
Yes, they're so salty.
Oh no.
So for me, canned peas, it's like a different food item than a fresh pea, but I think that canned peas are definitely the most acceptable of the canned vegetables.
Okay.
Especially if you're considering tomatoes to be a fruit. But canned peas, I would almost consider canned peas to be like 55.
See, for me, yeah, like generally speaking, like canned veggies are just like really rough going for me. I mean, when the apocalypse comes, like I'll crack open a can of peas and go, yay, these are going to give me some sustenance to go out and fight more zombies. But until that day comes, ooh, 20 for me.
Yeah. A 20?
Yeah, they might be.
Oh, see, for
Unless we're just also talking about, like, I mean, really, maybe the 20 are those, like, lead-poisoned canned foods that, like, made people go insane in the 1800s.
I mean, yes, maybe those are 20. I was just thinking that 20 is unexpired can.
Okay, sure,
of
sure.
Some kind of food that you also don't like.
Something that's like and gone bad. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gone bad. It's not just that it is past its expiration date. It is no longer consumable. So 55, 60, 70, and 80 are progressively better and better in the baseball world, but also in the canned food world, I suppose. For baseball, 80 represents a franchise player or a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I think, again, I'm going to probably put Spam actually in the like 55 range just because like there can be some miraculous things done with Spam in the right hands. I think that a lot of canned fruit, it becomes a little more like a dessert frequently and you lose some of the health properties, but it's delicious.
It's not bad. It's not bad. Canned peaches especially.
Yeah. Soup, of course.
Soup is what I was thinking of. Like, canned soup is still actively good, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And then can't forget those baked beans.
Baby. I had not forgotten the baked beans. I feel like of canned foods, baked beans are the 80 grade of canned foods.
Hall of Fame.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially just like, you know, Boston baked beans with like bacon in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would eat those cold out of a can. It's better hot.
I frequently have.
But
hobo style.
Oh, so good.
Mm-hmm.
Have we discussed whether or not we both used to eat beans on toast?
I think we have. And I think that I often was like, beans on toast, hold the toast, please. just getting in the way of those beans.
For me, it was definitely, it was for the part of my life when I was like, I have $50 a week for food. Beans on toast was a major staple for me.
When is your cookbook coming out, by the way?
Friends, I am not a cook. And I've become progressively less and less so in my life when I'm like, life is short. Have other people make your food. So I just want to say, before we move on to the categories, that there are some things in this movie that are not appropriate for younger audiences. And I know we have some younger listeners to this podcast, and we like to try to make it accessible for people of all ages, but this is a horror movie. There are some things that must be discussed that are not appropriate for younger audiences, and there is at least one occasion where I would like to quote a sentence with some swears in it. So this is our parental advisory for this episode. We're still going to try to keep things like PG-13 for the most part, but we just have to say this episode may not be appropriate for kids.
Ooh, yeah. You're leaning in, I can tell, as you're listening. Like, oh, boy.
Yeah. I mean, that's always
take
our
joke. Take me
into
the ball game after dark.
when there are the advisories at the start of a television episode, we're always like, ooh, a violence and implied sexuality. Like, whatever it is.
Yes, sweet.
So, on that note, let's move along to amount of baseball.
This is a kind of a weird category for this one, because this film, of course, does not have any proper baseball games. Mm-hmm. Like, society has collapsed.
Right.
There is very little in the way of population in this film.
Or organized anything,
although there is the orchard. We'll get to them. A zombie apocalypse, though, yeah, it rages through the land. And, you know, even if you added all of the speaking parts in this film together, you wouldn't have enough people to field even one baseball team.
Yes. I mean, a real baseball team. You could go...
We could put them up against the bench warmers?
We could put them up against the bench warmers.
That would be an amazing crossover.
And I mean, there are five speaking parts in this film and also five people pictured. So if you combined that to make six, I think that that was the number that during the Benchwarmers episode, we were like, you could plausibly sort of play baseball with six people.
That's fair.
So, I mean, hopefully they would just cream the Benchwarmers.
Yeah. Oh, here's hoping. Benchwarmers 3, come on, Happy Madison people, let's talk.
Oh Lord, I don't actually want to see that crossover at all.
The dudes, they've got a bat, they've got gloves, they throw a ball around a couple of times, and, you know, working on the curveball, they pretend to throw a guy out at home, they hit some rocks, they hit some apples, and then there's also things that are like not really baseball activity, but like have just like a certain baseball feel to them. You know, there's that scene in the end, like in the kind of like passing time in the car montage where they're throwing cards into a catcher's mitt, like mm-hmm. making use of the baseball things. I like that Ben is like eating sunflower seeds at one point, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. just like nice little, like genuinely nice little touches.
Mickey is good at spitting through his teeth.
Uh-huh. All of that said, I feel like this has to be probably a 30, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly want to give it a 40, but given the fact that there isn't really any proper play of baseball, even though them being players and certain baseball like customs and so on are very well integrated into the film, and baseball stuff is always kind of around, the fact that there aren't like baseball stakes and there isn't meaningful baseball activity means that even though there's like thoughtful and fun stuff there, like it really can't be anything more than a 30 to me.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we've ruled on this before, but I think that using a baseball bat to kill a zombie or do anything besides hit a baseball is something that I really appreciate as a thematic tie-in. It's sort of like baseball talk, but for me, and the more hard-lined way that my scouting director, Jim, views amount of baseball as a tool, it does not count. It doesn't count towards amount of baseball action.
It's funny. I was going to ask you the exact same, like, I was going to pose that question to you.
Well, we know each other pretty well.
And also be like, but what if it's like a bald guy who's got like marks on his head? So like his head like sort of looks like a baseball when it gets hit with
no.
it. Really? Even then?
No, not
wow,
even then.
Really hard line here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I mean, well, I respect. I don't know that I totally agree, but I respect
Jim's
it.
Jim's a traditionalist.
And I think that we end up on the same score, so.
Yeah. I have, however, decided to include the late scene in which Ben is unraveling a baseball.
That's
in
right, yeah.
Homage to Dr. Meredith Wills and her work dissecting baseballs, because Dr. Wills, you're my hero. And I'm including it basically because A, I don't think it changes the score. I think it's a 30 with or without that. And B, if this sets a precedent where dissecting a baseball needs to be considered amount of baseball, I think I'm okay with that. Like, I don't think that's going to come back to haunt me in a future film.
Yeah, yeah. And hey, kudos to Jeremy Gardner and, you know, the filmmaking team in general for that moment in the working on the curveball, playing catch moment where there's the line, it's fun, man, it's baseball. Yeah, kudos, working in the have more fun trope into a post-apocalyptic film. Into it.
Yes.
I love that.
Also, Brett Phillips agrees with you.
But yeah, and you know, this isn't really a baseball film. Arguably, it's not even really a zombie film. It's kind of like a indie buddy character study that just sort of like happens to take place in a zombie world.
Eventually, it very happens to take place in a zombie world, though.
But despite the fact that it's not like a proper baseball film, there's enough kind of baseball-related stuff that it seemed like this would be maybe a fun one to do, and I feel like it's justified, having seen it a couple of times
I'm
now.
I'm glad it's part of the Take Me Into the Ballgame universe,
yeah.
For sure.
The extended universe.
The extended universe.
Phase two.
So, shall we move along to our next tool?
Probably, yeah.
Probably. So, our next category is baseball accuracy. And as we've just discussed, there's not a lot to go on since there's not a lot of baseball to begin with.
Yeah.
And not even a ton of baseball talk. But there are a couple of things to note. And the main baseball accuracy issue that I have is when Mickey is talking to Annie over the walkie-talkie. So if you haven't seen this film, Mickey and Ben come across a couple of walkie-talkies, and as they're talking on them, a couple of other people sort of come over the wire discussing logistics, including obtaining the film Tremors.
Yeah, movie night, Tremors.
And they realize there are other people out there. So Frank tells them, get off this line, don't try to find us. Annie is insistent, get off this line, don't try to find us. However, Mickey tries very hard and is continually trying to talk to Annie on the walkie-talkie.
Yeah, because he's a lonely boy.
Because he's a lonely boy, as we will discuss. So, Mickey is talking to Annie, and he says that he and Ben didn't really know each other before the zombie apocalypse, my words, because now, his words, he was a starting pitcher and Mickey was a catcher. Okay, first, no. Number one, you're supposed to be best friends. Or if not, everything I've ever assumed is a lie, and I haven't had a week where I can deal with that kind of removal of a bedrock truth for me.
Does he say that he's a starter? I guess I don't remember that.
He does. Yeah. He says it, yes, because I was
I thought he said that he was
what?
Out of the bullpen.
Yes. So what he says, number two, Mickey says that he was out in the bullpen all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if he was a starting pitcher, he would have been either in the bullpen with Mickey or in the dugout with Mickey.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe he was lying to Annie about being a starting pitcher when he was actually a reliever, as there is the early scene in which Ben roasts Mickey for being a one-pitch pitcher. So it would make sense if he were a reliever. But given that they were minor league players, I didn't necessarily make the fact that he's a one-pitch pitcher in and of itself a problem for him being a starting pitcher.
Especially because Ben does say that it's a very good pitch.
Yes, and he does say it's a very good pitch. So the film would have gotten some positive baseball accuracy points from me if he were a relief pitcher and it said so. But I feel like I just have to assume that he is a starting pitcher, and so therefore there's some geography problems in addition to relationship problems.
Sure. Just to push back ever so slightly against that, I do believe that some of this could be explained a little bit, not fully, but a little bit, by the fact that I believe in that same moment or somewhere in the film, Ben is described as like the starting catcher. And I just got the sense that maybe Ben was a better catcher than Mickey was a pitcher. And so there might have been a little, like maybe they didn't interact quite as much as, you know, he was a probably emotional and slightly insecure, like not star of the rotation or bullpen or whatever, and that maybe that had something to do with the fact that they weren't necessarily close before this happened. But I could be reading into that a little bit, but that was sort of how my brain connected some of those dots.
Right. Well, if Mickey were a relief pitcher and...
Just because there might have been like other catchers that like worked with Mickey more, you know, in the same way that like, you know, JT Realmuto is probably not like the person who like, you know,
he's not warming up the relievers
exactly
in the bullpen.
Yeah, yeah.
So yes, if Mickey were a relief pitcher and he said he were a relief pitcher, it would all make a little bit more sense to me. And also, I don't know that it is as much of a bedrock principle for me that the relief pitchers are best friends with the catcher.
Right,
like, I'm sure
right.
they're friends, but not best friends.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, they're invited to the party, but they don't necessarily, like, plan the party with the catcher.
Yes, totally.
One quick positive historical nerdy thing that I think is kind of fun is that there are references to Pittsfield numerous times. I don't know that it's explicitly said that they, like, played in Pittsfield, but it...
They do have peas on their hats.
They do have peas on their hats. And so I think that that's kind of a safe bet. This movie was released in 2012, and it is worth noting that in 2010, 2011, all during that time, that community was home to the Pittsfield Colonels, which I think was an independent league team of some kind. And so they very well could have been a part of that team. Additionally, kind of a fun little thing that I don't know if there's any intention behind this or not, but Pittsfield does have the distinction of being among the first places referencing baseball. In 1791, a bylaw was enacted to bar, quote, any game of wicket, cricket, baseball, batball, football, cat, fives, or any other games played with a ball, end quote, within 80 yards of the apparently fancy new meeting house there. I think they were worried about the windows getting broken.
It's basically like, you will not have fun here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No fun within 80 yards of the meeting house.
America, no fun within 80 yards.
And so although, you know, like bat and ball games have been around forever, there's lots of contention about sort of like, when did one of those bat and ball games become something that we would recognize as baseball? That said, I believe this is among the earliest textual like references of baseball. I don't know that it's the earliest. I think there was one earlier from like Princeton in like 1786, but it's up there. And I think that's just like a kind of cool little Easter egg, intentional or no.
It's very cool. And I feel like I have faith enough in Jeremy Gardner that it's probably intentional.
Yeah.
However, I would like to address the statement that in Latin America, they don't let kids throw curveballs, just changeups, because it's easier on the shoulder. I believe it's Mickey who says this.
Yes.
And this is partly true. First of all, throwing breaking balls is discouraged almost everywhere for kids younger than 13 or 14. This doesn't mean that kids don't do it, because there's speculation that this is part of why elbow injuries and Tommy John surgery are up for teenagers. Although there are other factors like how much of the year they spend throwing and stuff like that. But I think the main issue here is the elbow with the forearm twist for the curveball, although obviously that whole side of the anatomy is heavily involved. But on the other point about Latin America, it may also be a bit of a generalization. So I found a very interesting baseball prospectus article by Octavio Hernandez from 2016. So it's a little out of date for today, but this is the 2012 movie. So Hernandez compares the difference between Dominican and Venezuelan pitchers, which are, of course, the two largest countries of origin for MLB players after the U.S. In 2021, about 10% of MLB players are Dominican and about 7% are Venezuelan. So Hernandez found that in 2015, 10.3% of the league's pitches were changeups. For Dominicans, it was only 9.4%, but for Venezuelans, it was 13.4%, a lot more. So this statement that Mickey makes would be maybe true for Venezuelans, but not true for Dominicans.
Oh, wow.
And as you might expect, Dominicans actually throw more breaking balls, although those are mostly sliders. It is true that in 2015, the league threw 7.1% curveballs, with Dominicans throwing 5.7% and Venezuelans throwing 5%. So, interesting.
Yeah.
Things we talk about when we talk about zombie movies. I am not counting as a baseball inaccuracy the fact that they both smoke like chimneys, despite being athletes, because A, it's the zombie apocalypse, and I'd probably take up smoking. And B, the John Kroc anecdote that I have often cited, in which a woman was like, how can you smoke and be an athlete? And he was like, I'm not an athlete. I'm a ball player. I am calling this the Kroc defense.
Ooh, I like that.
And I am taking it here.
Yeah. I'm into that. That's a really good point. I guess I really hadn't thought about that, but in fairness, also, we don't necessarily know like when they started smoking. You get the sense that maybe Ben's been smoking longer than Mickey has. Maybe Mickey just picked it up when things went to shit in the same way that, like, I don't know, those first couple of months of COVID, I was just like, screw it. I'm going to eat and drink a lot of gross stuff because, like, nothing's changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
So maybe it was a similar mentality that led to him being a regular smoker. And maybe he was just a sort of like steal one from a friend at a party every now and then kind of person before then.
Yeah, I feel like, number one, there are fewer pleasures for you in the zombie apocalypse. And number two, I feel like you're a little less concerned with your life expectancy.
Yeah, totally agree.
So for me, overall, for baseball accuracy, I'm going to go 45.
Okay.
And yeah, there's not a lot to go on, and it's some pretty minor points that are sort of quibblingly inaccurate.
I am right at a 50, and I do that a little bit in that kind of standard, I did not have that many problems, and there is not a huge amount of information to go off of. So I'm doing the kind of like default 50 move here a little bit.
That's fair. So what about storytelling?
I find the storytelling in this film to be pretty impressive, to be honest. It's a simple story in a lot of ways, right? Like, it's these two former teammates who are kind of roaming around, and they encounter a couple of moments of danger. They get trapped in a car. There's not a lot of complexity to the story, but I do think that it's very well told. I think it's very well edited. And I think that there's a lot of really smart ways of establishing the fundamental dynamic between these two characters, mm-hmm, to completely dumb it down. It's like the chill one and the wound up one, or the one who has accepted the current reality and the one who is in denial about it. Right from the get-go, the very first shot in the film, one of many long kind of static, mm-hmm, shots, mm-hmm, in the film, we see Mickey outside of a house, listening to music, and then changing batteries, the batteries.
It's so good.
And he's just in his own world. And if you went into this film blind, you wouldn't have a sense of like anything until Ben comes like running out and like shooting inside. Like, that establishes their characters so well right away. And I think that that's like, I think that that's super, super cool.
Yeah.
And like Mickey scratching lottery tickets, like as an activity to sort of pass the time, but then like getting really happy because like one of them was a big winner. He's completely separated from the world that he's in. And I feel like the movie has a lot of like really smart, subtle, not overplaying its hand moments that illustrate the dynamic between these people and kind of their own little isms. And since so much of the film essentially works as like a character study of like, here are these two different types of people in this crazy circumstance, that level of detail to those things is huge in terms of like the movie being able to work.
Yeah. I think that the storytelling in this movie is fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that it's actually deceptively simple. I think there's more things going on in this movie. There are more different threads going on in the storytelling than it even seems like there are. And they're all so excellently sown to be reaped at just the right moment. Because, yes, the very first things that you're learning are, number one, this is a zombie apocalypse, but also who are these people and who are they to each other and what are their personalities and what are their dynamics? And so just when we're starting to wonder, where are they going? Why are they just wandering around? Boom. There's the scene on the back deck, and we learn that they were trapped in a house for a few months, but then we're suddenly asking the questions like, well, how were they trapped, and how did they get out? And those questions came to my mind in that scene, but we spend the entire journey of the movie finding out the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And the way that the breadcrumbs are dropped for it, it is impeccably placed. And personally, that's how I like my storytelling. I feel like so often there's either like, we need to know all of the answer to these things now, as if the only way that the past can function in a movie is for the groundwork of whatever action or romance or whatever else is going to take place, rather than that the unraveling of that question is part of the fabric of the storytelling itself. So it's either that or else something like that is looked on as sort of like a minor storytelling point rather than a cornerstone. Like, that couldn't possibly be interesting enough. We need a bunch of different plot lines in there. But I think the mystery of that for the audience is a big driving force for this film.
For sure.
And it is just so skillfully planted.
Yeah. Yeah. I love, like, very specific and, I don't know, very satisfying sensory details that are included. I love like how bad the car stinks.
Yes.
When
they steal it from the zombie.
When they steal it. when they carjack the zombie. I love that. And similarly, when they're trapped in the car and like Ben is taking off his shoes and they make like a big deal about like how bad it, like those kinds of details I think are super important. Another long shot is one where they are just brushing their teeth. And honestly, it's just like, it's so well framed. The music is good. It's active. We're learning about these guys, their relationship, their routine. We're getting information about what their life is in this world. I know that this is the kind of thing that a certain type of film goer, particularly a certain type of like horror film goer, this kind of thing can be a turnoff to, because it's a little more like art film than horror film in the way that some of these shots are staged, the length of them, and the fact that it's really interested in behavior and the relationship between these two people, as opposed to like various action set pieces, which I think, you know, there are people who go to horror films expecting like a thriller where like something crazy is going to happen and it's going to up the stakes. Like, I don't know, there was that, I can't remember the name of it, but the like zombie like heist movie that Zack Snyder did that like just came out on Netflix that I think I made you watch a couple of scenes of. And it
I've
is
blocked this out
along
apparently
those lines.
I don't remember it.
I made you watch a couple of scenes because I was making a big argument about how I think Dave Bautista is a great actor.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, I remember those. Yes, because I remember Dave Bautista being a great actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to circle back for just a minute on the very long takes. Because
yeah.
that is, I mean, there are so many things that I just like love about the storytelling in this movie. But to me, that is so central to the way that the film storytelling is so well integrated with the script. So I think the script is really excellent. But then I also feel like the filmic storytelling of that, I think it's really excellent. And I mean, I love long takes generally. And I don't know if it's just the actor side of me that I really like being able to see all the behavior and also know that everything that was happening in relation to everything else
totally.
Really in that moment. Mm-hmm. It gives me a kind of a visceral thrill, long takes do.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that long takes are also this sort of perfect meta storytelling way to illustrate their lives. Like, I loved the toothbrushing scene.
Yeah.
Although it did make me think, how do they get fresh water in this world? Like, is that an issue for them? Are they also scavenging for water? We don't really see that. I don't know. But it made me think about those kind of things. And I don't think that's a bad thing, even, that I was thinking about that. But I think the long takes, they obviously culminate in the very long scene just on Ben.
Yeah.
When
it's like 11 minutes-ish
yes.
long. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very long. So if you have not seen this movie, they get trapped in their station wagon because Annie, who we mentioned earlier, has thrown their keys into the field and also shot Ben in the leg. And Mickey is not able to find the keys before night falls.
This is all done as a like, we don't want to be found. Don't follow us. We are going to do this to make it hard for you to, like, it's going to take some time for you to find the keys and get back. And by the time you do, we're going to be long gone. Except as this happens, a bunch of zombies come in before they find the keys. And so they're just like stranded in this car.
Yes. And the entire like back third of the movie is them being stranded in the car.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess for people who want a lot of action and a lot of jump scares and stuff like that, it will be unsatisfying.
Yeah.
But the notion of being trapped in a station wagon surrounded by zombies is so horrifying to me. It is so completely miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I realized like the moment, and it was very early in The Walking Dead that I was like, I can't do this. I'm out. Was the moment when people were like trapped in a house and you could hear the zombies on the outside.
Yeah.
And that is, I think maybe it's my claustrophobia. I don't know.
Sure.
But that is scarier to me than a sequence of like trying to shoot a bunch of zombies or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. And to be clear, this is not a film that has jump scares. It's not a film that's very heavy on gore, but it does have a pretty healthy dose of dread.
Yes.
And definitely the sequence that we're describing that, yeah, is the last 30, 35 minutes of the film has a certain darkness to it, even though so much of it is really just like these two guys hanging out in a car, not knowing what to do because there are zombies banging at the window.
Yes. I mean, I will say the last third of this movie suffocated me with anxiety. Like, well done, movie. I was so intensely miserable, and that is part of what a good job this movie does. And so the excruciating 11-minute scene in which Ben is just waiting to see if Mickey is going to make it back and he smokes an entire cigarette. It's the culmination of the film language of the long shots. And I also feel like it's sort of the culmination of the anxiety and the dread of the entire movie.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like we should also really give props to the entire like production team for this sequence, because to film this much of the movie, having it be essentially just like people sitting in the back of a station wagon, it is not an easy thing to have that much story be in this confined static space and have the storytelling still feel like dynamic, like things are happening, finding different angles, to have it be visually interesting, whether it's because of where the camera is placed or because of the various activities that the performers are doing. And I feel like
they do a pretty great job.
And when you think about the fact that this is the feature like debut of all involved, right? Of Jeremy Gardner, of Adam Kronheim, of Christian Stella, they had done some stuff before, but to make a feature length film, like this whole section, I think there are many, many much more seasoned filmmakers who would run into a lot of problems that they kind of deftly avoided or sidestepped.
Yes, particularly since, so some of the information that Eric and I have are because we watched a making of documentary of this movie in addition to watching the movie. And Jeremy Gardner at one point said that they went into shooting like without really a set schedule or without a shot list, which just blew my mind.
Yeah.
Because then they do get so many really interesting shots.
Yeah.
And so many different ways of figuring out how to tell a story in a confined space. It wasn't storyboarded in advance. Just like, it blows my mind. It's really crazy.
Yeah, this is a feature-length documentary called Tools of Ignorance that is available on the DVD and Blu-ray of The Battery and is very worth checking out. I know that Christian Stella has hopes to put it on YouTube at some point in the future, but I have no idea what kind of timeline that might be. Tools of Ignorance, by the way, is a term that is given to catcher's protective equipment. And so that's just like adding a little bit of baseball in there as well. But it's really great. And so you really get a sense of just like how like guerrilla filmmaking this entire thing was through that. And there are many problems that come up with any production because it is a hard thing to make a thing.
It's very
generally
hard to make a thing.
But when you are shooting a film in 16 days with $6,000, when things go wrong, it is harder to right the cart, as it were.
So to pick up one of the threads of this movie, the very first time that Ben jumps to the conclusion that Mickey has a thing for Annie, having only heard her voice on the radio, I thought, this is a bit swift. And it could partly be because of the pace of the movie, which is generally very considered.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like the pace is like, these guys don't have anywhere to be, and neither does this movie, in a good way. I didn't quite buy that one moment. And I don't know if it's because the sort of like, wait a second, you like her, don't you? It's sort of almost a trope.
Yeah, that didn't bother me that much. I feel like at that point, Ben was well aware of like Mickey's like crap. And so he just like had, I feel like it didn't come out of nowhere that he went to that place personally.
Well, let me get there.
Yeah,
So the moment when I first saw it, it felt like just sort of a fictional TV paced kind of moment.
Hmm.
Like Eric and I are watching Loki, although we haven't finished it. And there's basically an identical moment in Loki, which, I mean, that's also a very well-written show. So that's not like an insult to say that. But it feels like a story moment rather than a life moment, kind of.
Okay.
But this is all sort of a diversion from my point, which is, as an audience member, we need that moment for the storyline that I will just call the, like, Mickey needs some action storyline, which is really superbly paced and, like, well-planted, like everything else, in terms of visiting his dead girlfriend's room and then the masturbation scene and continuing to pursue Annie, which is really the downfall for both of them, as we've discussed.
I'm assuming we're going to be talking about that masturbation scene in a different category.
Of course we are. Yes, that's part of the reason why I was like, this episode might not be for younger listeners. So if it were just about finding Annie and finding the orchard, the storyline wouldn't be as well plotted and psychologically complex. And I, as a viewer, go back and I'm like, oh, that moment, just like you said, that moment for Ben was so swift, as an indication of the fact that, like, Ben already knows where Mickey's mind is going because he's been on the road with him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even though for us, the audience, it's the first time that we're learning that thing.
Sure.
So to me, that's why, like, I don't think it's that simple of a story because there's so many different little things that kind of run through it and they all come together perfectly, which makes it seem like it's simple, but it's actually a lot of kind of different things just being woven in together really well.
I mean simple in terms of plot, in terms of like main like story, like, and then this happens and then this happens and then this happens. Like, there is a wealth of like little micro moments and like very, very full relationships on display. But I think that it ultimately has to do with that and is not necessarily a film that is heavy on plot.
Yeah, I think that's maybe fair. But I think that there's more plot than people might give it credit to.
Okay.
Credit for, is I guess part of what I'm saying. I also felt like it was good at setting up expectations that it subverted. So the sort of the sequence in which Mickey insists that they're going to stay in a house for a night. And I definitely thought, that's it. Like, there's going to be a zombie showdown in this house. And Ben has the headphones and he's listening to Rock Plaza Central and he's not going to hear them. And Mickey is staying in the room with all these like creepy portraits. And I was like, don't stay in the room with the creepy portraits. And then when it turns out that the showdown is Ben forcing Mickey to kill a zombie, that's cool.
Yeah.
Like, storytelling wise, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it's such a great moment also because it's such a terrible thing for Ben to do to Mickey, but I also totally understand why Ben is doing it.
Yep.
Like, I'm kind of for and against both parties.
Yes.
In this.
Yes.
Like, it's hard in this dynamic, again, this like ostensibly simple dynamic of like the chill surviving one and the wound up denial person, that within that dynamic, there's a lot of complexity and a lot of room to agree with and disagree with both people. And I think that that's just really, really satisfying to watch.
Yeah, it's so good. And the way that Mickey walks out of the house afterwards, I felt myself thinking, did he get nicked somehow? Is he turning into a zombie? Like, is that...
That's cool.
You know, because, like, we don't know what that looks like in this world. We haven't seen it.
Yeah, we don't see anybody, like, turn or, like...
Yeah, we don't ever see anybody,
you know,
turn into
zombie.
Some zombie
movies, it takes a few days. Sometimes it takes just, like, a couple minutes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So I was like, is that this moment? It played with my expectations really well.
Another fun playing of expectations. This is just like the kind of thing that I think this movie is really, really good at. There is a moment in the house where Mickey is pissed off at Ben, and Ben is in another room, and he's like, hey, you should come in here and check out this mural. And then he describes this like crazy mural with like a beautiful woman and forest creatures and all this stuff going on. And it plays in the moment very much like Ben is just like goofing off. He's trying to get Mickey to come into the room. Like, it's not a big deal. It's just like a fun, silly moment that, again, like, just like really, really just sort of like shows them in this particular point of their like relationship, their friendship. And then, like, two scenes later, when we see Ben dancing and listening to Rock Plaza Central, we see the mural in that like sequence, and it's like exactly as Ben described it. And so I think that that's just like a funny play of expectations of like, oh, we thought it was one thing. Oh no, like he, like, yep, that was an actual mural.
That's
so funny and so good. And it doesn't underline it. It just shows you the thing while in the midst of doing something else. And I love that. I love that this film, in general, trusts the intelligence, mm-hmm, of its audience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really great. It also did make me wonder, knowing that their budget was $6,000, probably that's just a mural that they found.
Yeah, and they were like, let's shoot some stuff. Yeah.
Let's work this into the script where Mickey's in the other room and Ben's in here talking about this mural. Like, you know that's what they did.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't have written that and then made the mural. They didn't probably have the funds for that.
Totally.
Or the time.
And that lines up with some of the things that we've learned from watching the documentary and reading some stuff also about inspirations and goals. One of the big influences on the aesthetic of this film was the excellent David Gordon Green film, All the Real Girls, which similarly, and within the David Gordon Green aesthetic also, is like, we have like an established script, but we're going to be sort of loose with it. And I think a lot of the setups kind of emulate that a little bit as well. It's not like copying it, it's its own thing. But I think that that sort of lines up with like, no, we've got this plan, we're going to do this thing, but we're going to allow ourselves room to let it be something else depending on where we are and what's happening. And I think that's just awesome.
Yeah, I think it makes for a better film, actually, the flexibility that they had.
Yeah. So, I don't know, like, I wrote 60, I think I might be a 70.
I'm easily a 70.
Yeah. So, like, good
job. It's not even a
job
question in my mind.
Storytelling.
Good job
for
storytelling.
This film. It's really, really, really exceptional, I think.
I completely agree.
Yay.
So, our next tool is the score tool.
Score tool!
And from the first moment that I heard Chris Eaton's voice, I was like, this whole movie is for Eric.
It's totally true. It's totally
because
true.
This is Eric's music.
I think
Rock Plaza Central is great, but voices that kind of twist with emotion, this is really Eric's thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I did an episode of Al Melchior's great podcast, You, Me, and an Album. Ellen did one first, but I almost chose Rock Plaza Central as the album to talk about in my particular episode. And listening to it on this film, I was like, oh boy, if Al brings me back, I think I'm going to have to talk about it. It's so good.
Yes, but to clarify, Eric actually chose...
I chose Neutral Milk Hotels
in the airplane over the sea.
Yeah.
And I chose Chance the Rapper's Coloring Book for mine. So I don't know, maybe that tells you all that you need to know. Because I remember when we first started dating, you made me a mix CD because, gentle listeners, that's how long ago it was when we first started dating.
Uh-huh.
And Rock Plaza Central was on there. And I was like, okay, This is a cool guy. And he likes a lot of music that's good, but also sounds sort of unpleasant. And
how dare you?
It's just the truth. I'm sure I put very annoying things on my CD to you because I am definitely less cool about music than you are. And I think that Rock Plaza Central is good. Like, I don't necessarily want to sit down and listen to it myself, but I don't want to punch them. Because Eric definitely has a subset of music that he listens to where I just really want to punch the person who's singing.
It's true.
Yeah. But Rock Plaza Central, I don't want to punch them. And they are perfect for this movie.
Absolutely perfect.
They are perfect for this world. And there are a lot of great songs that we hear in this movie because the characters, mostly Mickey, are listening to them on the headphones that are a real plot point. And at one point in the documentary that we referenced earlier, Jeremy says that music is really a character in the film, and it's so true.
Absolutely. And there is a lot of Rock Plaza Central, and I mean, the great sequence with Anthem for the Already Defeated.
Mm-hmm. When we dance together under the moon and under the weather.
Which is maybe my favorite song of theirs, although there's many, many, many good songs. And also Chris Eaton of Rock Plaza Central, the film opens when we get past that initial scene, that initial shot, and we go to the kind of like opening credits, we have Chris Eaton of Rock Plaza Central covering this classic old gospel song, Ain't No Grave, which was written by and originally sung by Brother Claude Ely. And what do you think I've seen? I've seen a band of angels that's coming after me. I think that his version of it, it's a really cool and satisfying version that I think honors the original really, really, really well. There's also just wonderful, wonderful music by other groups. Sun Hotel has some stuff.
I was sleeping in my father's house.
I think my favorite of the songs are the Wise Blood ones. So,
oh, sure.
Yeah, yeah, that's the song that opens the movie that Mickey is listening to. It's mm-hmm. like B-I-G-E-G-O. And then also the one that he listens to when they're stuck in the car and the zombie noises are too much for him.
Sure.
I love both of those songs.
Also a big fan of the song The Time of the Dragonflies by The Parlor that appears. Learning how to disappear, but all of this is to say, I mean, like, partly I just want to mention all these things so that I can, like, put in a bunch of, like, little samples of all the cool songs that are in this film. But this has a banging soundtrack, as far as I'm concerned. But in addition to that, we have a very good score by Ryan Winford. Score.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic. And I had more appreciation for it when we learned through the making of documentary that the composer used a lot of objects to create percussion.
Sure.
Like a toaster and a beer bottle. He also recorded humming from transformers and elevator shafts to get the sort of eerie, humming, impending dread soundscape.
Totally, totally. So, it's a very guitar-forward score, but it's filled out with a lot of this really interesting stuff. It's great.
Yeah, it's really great. So I say, all in all, well freaking done, 70. I think it's a 70.
Yeah, I'm a 70 as well. There's a part of me that wants to go 80, but I think that for an 80 with score, you really need that, like, iconic, like a sort of like John Williams, like, you, it needs to have like that hummable, like, oh my God, like, yeah, like it needs, well, actually, funnily
it needs
enough,
to be a Hall of Famer.
Like John Williams in like Jaws, for example, which is, I believe, Jeremy Gardner's favorite film, which is why there is the moment where they sing the show me the way to go home.
Yeah.
A la the moment when they are singing it in Jaws.
Yeah, it's another really excellent sort of way that music tells this story.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was convinced you were going to go 80.
I really, really was tempted to, but I think that there, again, is something that for me, an 80 almost needs to have that, like, dun da dun da dun da da. Like, it needs to have like a thing where you're like, oh right, that score.
That score. Yeah. No, I sort of agree with you.
But that is literally the only thing holding it back in that respect for me from being an 80.
So what do you think about acting?
Well, I think the acting's pretty good. I think that Jeremy Gardner is great. He has so much ease in what he's doing, just really grounded, fills out the character. Adam Kronheim, I think, also is great, who is someone who, like, hadn't really acted before. I will say, with an asterisk next to him, that I don't actually know, like, what kind of range he has as an actor. I don't know what sort of, like, technical skills he could bring to the table under different circumstances and with a different character. But I think that he is very good at meeting the needs of this. I think that all in all, I'm like somewhere in the 55-60 zone, all told.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. This category is a little bit difficult for me. It feels like the most difficult one that we've done so far. And it's partly, we've talked about this with other indie films, just the difficulty of doing something that's lower budget, even if it's not $6,000 for crying out loud. Like, you just don't get time. You might want another take. The director might want another take, but there just isn't time for it. And you're fighting so many things, and you just have to sort of try to go up there and hope that you nail it in the two takes that you get. So here's what I'll say for sure. I think Jeremy Gardner is great.
Yeah.
Yes. So, like, speaking of that long scene in the car, it is genius, especially since I would bet that all of the zombie sounds and everything that were added in post, and he didn't even have the sort of sound bed scene partners. I bet he was just sitting in a car.
Yeah.
And he's just amazing.
Yeah.
And he's very relaxed and spontaneous and believable, but he also really, like, goes to the emotional depths. And
this is, again, like a static shot. And so there is, in this 11-minute shot, like, the beginning and end of it have Mickey in it as well, but then he leaves. And then the vast majority of that time is just this pretty still frame. And we're just watching Ben waiting. And he fills that space.
He fills it.
It is very compelling to watch.
It's so good. It's so good. And the notion to me that he also did everything that he did in this film without having an outside director's eye. Mm-hmm. And without, this was a moment where it was learned in the documentary that they didn't have monitors. And I was like, oh God, he didn't have a monitor? He was in a thing that he was directing and there weren't monitors. It blows my mind.
Yeah. And because of their schedule and all that, I think he says in the documentary at one point that 11 minute take, that they did it like twice,
yeah.
I think. And so to think about that without a monitor, and granted, a lot of it's him smoking a cigarette, having, you know, his behavior and all that, but like, it's all very full, mm-hmm. and none of it rings false. None of it's like, oh, actually, I shouldn't do that. That's like a actory thing to do. It's really, really impressive.
Yeah, it's really good. So to me, he's easily a 60.
Yeah.
But to me, I don't know. I don't know that Adam Kronheim's performance always reached a 50 for me. And I felt kind of relieved to learn that this was his first ever movie. Well, I don't know, maybe not relieved, because, like, if so, amazing work. Like, I wish that my first movie were this good. It's definitely like a 60 grade first movie performance. But I don't know, to me, it's a little bit more of a 50 for him. And there are plenty of 55 grade moments, but there were a couple of moments that I didn't quite buy.
Okay.
That were sort of like 45s. And I think one of the things for me was that his diction was kind of theatrical. And actually, I felt like that would work for plenty of other characters, but it sort of felt a little out of place for me, for sort of former ball player in zombie apocalypse. Like, I wanted, and maybe this is going to your point about, like, technical skills, I wanted something that was technically softening the language a little bit.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is something that I think about a lot, since I have theatrical diction in life, and I feel like people don't realize that I am almost always doing dialect work on camera because I speak like no real human beings who currently live. Anyway, like, my point is, it plays, but I don't know that it's more than just average productive major league performance.
All right, that's fair. I will say that I did notice some of those same things with regards to diction, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, I didn't really have a problem with it because it, at the very least, lines up with the tension in that character.
Mm.
But I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just saying that, like, for me, it wasn't a huge issue for that
reason.
It just
felt a little actory for me.
Yeah.
Just, like, ever so slightly.
I think I'm going to be bold, though, and I'm going to commit to a 60, actually.
Okay.
Just because, like, I think there's an argument to be made that Jeremy Gardner is above a 60.
I think there's that argument as well, but I still feel like the acting on the whole that I receive from this movie, I don't know that it's more than a 55.
All right.
So I think I'm going to go with 55.
Cool. Well, we're pretty close.
Yeah. So the next category is the delightfulness of catcher character. And since Ben is in practically every scene in this movie, it's rare that we get such a large amount of catcher in a film. And I feel like delightfulness is maybe a hard word to use, at least vis-a-vis my anxiety watching such films as this.
Okay.
But even with that proviso, I think that Ben is an exceedingly delightful catcher.
Oh, I so agree.
Yeah.
I was worried that you were like winding up for, you know, something other
than
that.
No, I was just sort of like, delightfulness doesn't quite feel like the right word.
Sure.
But if I'm scoring the appropriateness and excellence of the catcher character. So the best self-referential catcher line is when he says, "I'm a catcher. I'm allowed to be fat." And it got like 12,000 delightfulness points from me.
Mm-hmm.
And
I saw her write them down.
Yes. This is a scene that he ends by saying, "Fuck you, sir. Fuck you to death." And I was like, I love him. He is a catcher.
Yeah.
And since you had seen this movie before, you might not be able to answer this question. But for me, definitely, I knew going into the movie, it was about a pitcher and a catcher, the battery. And I definitely thought hard immediately from the first shot. I was like, which one is the pitcher and which one is the catcher?
Yeah.
And I was right.
Nice.
Because that's
there you go.
How well the catcher and pitcher archetypes were used by Jeremy Gardner. And I think that even the moments that might be controversial to call him catcher-esque, I think they're right in this world.
Okay.
So, I mean, this goes back to a moment that we've talked about before, but I feel like, yes, your lovable team leader might force you to kill a zombie if you keep chickening out from killing zombies, but it's for your own good. To me, that's a catcher all over. So I'm a 70.
I am also a 70. I mean, he's trying to keep his pitcher safe. He's trying to cheer him up. He's vowing to avenge his pitcher after the actions of the Orchard, this mysterious group that they interact with a couple of people on the radio with. Yeah, like, that is awesome. He's smart. He's goofy. It's great.
He's the best.
And I feel like there's a really good integration. This is a little bit storytelling, but I am going to include it in Delightfulness of Catcher. I think that there are also moments where, in non-catcher related things, he's just like talking like a catcher, which I really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
When he is talking to Mickey about the sort of effort to go get the keys, we didn't really talk about this, but
we did a little bit.
We did a little bit. But so for people who haven't seen the film, Ben is shot and they have this sort of last kind of gambit to have Mickey escape through the sunroof, run, find the keys, and come back. And if he doesn't find the keys, maybe just leave Ben there. Mickey says, absolutely, I'm not going to do that. But Mickey does come back, but he's bit. And then Ben has to kill Mickey because he's bit. And that is that's one of the kind of like dramatic high points of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But right before he goes out, Ben to Mickey says, stay low, go hard. And to me, that felt so akin to like a catcher like calling a pitch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I loved that so much.
Yeah.
I thought that was really, really, really fun.
Really great.
Yeah. So I'm also a 70.
But what about delightfulness of announcer?
20. There's no announcer, baby.
Nope.
Not even a radio. There's the Orchard dude, I guess. But he's not announcing anything except for Ben and Mickey to mind their own business. that's another great storytelling thing of just how Ben turns on the radio when they get into that station wagon and there's just no stations. Like, just like really nice, simple way to establish what's going on and where they are.
Yep.
And where they are is a place with no announcer, 20.
Indeed, 20. So our final category is lack of misogyny. And this is hard. This is very, very, very hard.
It's a little tricksy.
So this is a buddy movie reduced to its essence. And in the wide open claustrophobia of this world, there are very few other characters of any kind.
Yep.
I mean, to the point where I feel a little bad that we didn't talk about the other actors during acting.
Sure.
But they were good, and they didn't really contribute to the score, because mostly this film is Jeremy Gardner and Adam Kronheim. So, to that point, the only female roles in this movie are objectified and also evil or adversarial, kind of. Like,
okay.
One will shoot you in the leg and one will eat your brains.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the shooting in the leg incident, just to be fair, the zombies that surrounded the car were not a part of Annie's design. So I think I have a slightly more generous attitude maybe than you do about Annie, because she could have just killed both of them.
It's true.
But didn't. And was like, no, I'm going to let you live, but I'm going to make it very hard for you to follow us back to the orchard. And the orchard also is a thing that, by the way, this like group, this mysterious group, it's unclear whether or not that's a good thing. There are many, many hints that are given that it's actually kind of like a, I believe the term is, not cool place to live. And so that's an interesting dynamic as well. There's so much really good complexity here of like, oh, there's this other place, but like, also, is it even good? Like, so good to
really
layer
excellent.
That in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did not exactly have that same issue with Annie, but there is stuff to mull over with regards to the sexy lady zombie, to be sure.
Yes. Yes. I mean, for me, when I think about this category, I don't think that Annie is a bad person. When I'm thinking about this category, I'm very much thinking, but like, how do they function in the story?
Sure.
And how Annie functions in the story is, number one, as a love object.
Mickey's fantasy.
Mickey's fantasy.
Yeah.
And then as the orchestrator of at least ultimately Mickey's demise, whether or not she intended to do that. So
no, her actions lead to him dying, for
right,
sure.
Her actions lead to him dying and lead to like great misery from the two of them.
Yeah.
And so if I were playing Annie, I wouldn't think like I'm playing the villain of this movie. But that sort of storytelling wise, she just sort of flips from being the love interest to being the villain. And this isn't helped. We're going to get to the sexy lady zombie in a minute. But this isn't helped by the misogyny of the imagined figuration of Annie before we meet her.
Right.
So when Mickey is first infatuated with the idea of Annie over the walkie-talkies, Ben makes fun of his idea of her versus who she probably is. And let's just say there's a lot of judgment on 46-year-old softball coaches, for example. And it's sort of the old trope of there only being two kinds of women.
Yeah.
As if there isn't space for like a well-rounded human being in Ben's imagination between a bull dyke and Frank's barely legal niece.
Yeah.
Are quotes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just to like clarify very quickly, Ben, his whole thing to Mickey about that is that he's like mocking Mickey because he believes that like Mickey thinks that Annie is somewhat like a super hot, like like Laura Croft, like gun at the hip, like beautiful, sexy adventurer ready for action, when in reality, in his opinion, Annie is probably like a stocky, unconventionally attractive to men lady of some sort. Yeah.
And I mean, I get that Ben's point of view isn't the film's point of view.
Sure.
It's a character thing that Jeremy created. And I think that this is clear because both of their points of view get shown up. So both Mickey's obsession with her, but also Ben's view of some kind of womanhood binary.
When
like the real person who shows up is attractive, but not like a sort of Mad Max Fury Road, like post-apocalyptic, you know.
Totally.
Lady who's got a gun on her hip. But I don't know if it's enough to offset the negative points for the existence of the misogyny in Ben's earlier speech.
Yeah. Just a quick thing to say that Alana O'Brien, who plays Annie, I think does a really good job and is one of the people that we didn't talk about with acting. And all of these issues that we are talking about, like none of them obviously
none of them
stem
reflect
from
on
that
her performance. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think it's a good performance.
I think it's a good performance too. Yeah. I was sort of like, I feel like I'm at like a 55 for her and like a 50 for Niels Ball. I might be mispronouncing him. And so that's why my score remained the same for them. But I think that they play their roles very well. So that's sort of the whole Annie question. That's one part of it. And then the only other female character in the film, I mean, there are other zombies who used to be living female women.
And there's the missing / dead / probably a zombie girlfriend who is a character, but not a character portrayed by a person on screen.
Nobody got a job.
Yeah.
So how do we feel about objectifying a zombie?
It's very strange. It's a very interesting question because if if you can't, like, it's funny that masturbating to a zombie seems weird and like maybe kind of wrong, but like killing zombies doesn't seem like as big of a deal. I feel like it's a weird, like, a part of the whole, like, American, like...
Exactly. Yeah, we're like, oh,
violence
goodness.
Good, sex bad.
Exactly.
Kind of thing. Especially because, like, it's... I don't know. I didn't have a huge problem with that moment, even though, like, my antenna came up and I was like, uh-oh, this feels, like, kind of thorny. Ultimately, I feel like this is telling of Mickey's deep loneliness and his struggle to survive in the world that he's in. And so, although I think that there are disturbing moments about it, there are moments that are kind of funny about it because Ben catches him doing it and like mocks him relentlessly for a bit. That's a contradiction, relentlessly for a bit, but sure, why not?
I think that's almost what happens,
though. Yeah. I don't, there's something that I found like very sad about the scene of just sort of like, oh man, this is where this dude is at.
This is where this dude is at. So narratively, I think this scene is great. And I even think that the extremity of it in the midst of this movie is great. I think structurally, we want the punch of this.
Yeah.
We want to be like, oh, wow, that's where he is.
Yeah.
Because I think that it provides an important context for him trying to get in touch with Annie.
Yeah.
I think to me, it made me feel for that a little bit more because we recognize the depths of his desperation. And I am certainly not here to vilify masturbation. Like, it's basically the only option that he's got in the world that they're living in. And even if it weren't, it's fine. Like, go for it.
Hey, to quote Woody Allen, it's sex with someone I love.
And I don't think that the zombie is aware enough that we can be upset for her that he exposes himself to her.
Yeah.
Like, she's just thinking about brains. in her undead life.
Presumably.
Yeah.
There's the brains thing is like a was really literally putting my glasses.
Is that a harmful stereotype for me to say that she's just thinking about brains?
Well, it was really established by Return of the Living Dead, and it caught on, and I think that that's great because Return of the Living Dead is so good, and I love it. But brains have not always been a part of the zombie universe, but I dig it.
Okay. But, all right.
Yeah. Anyway, this is your zombie lesson of this particular episode.
So in the fact that she's a zombie, mm-hmm. I think actually it's fine. But also it's a dead human being. So yeah. My question is sort of, is this part of the objectification of young, beautiful, dead women? And that's kind of, I think it needs negative misogyny points. Like, if that's what I'm scoring, I don't want it gone. I think this scene is great. I applaud this scene's existence.
Yeah.
And the movie's attitude is, this is really messed up. But it's just, it's not boosting lack of misogyny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, this is really hard. And I feel like I'm going 30.
Okay, I'm a 40, and I completely understand your 30. I'm going to go a little bit higher, but I get it.
But I think that's totally fair, because it doesn't make me angry. It's just when I had to reckon up, well, what's this lack of misogyny? Like, I don't think that this movie has a misogynist heart.
For
but
sure.
It's not doing anything good for women at literally any point in the entire movie.
I maybe disagree a little bit with regards to Annie, but we've already talked about that. Yeah. And like, I think we get each other with this. But yeah, yeah. I'll go a 40 with it, but I get your 30.
It's a sad 30, though.
Yeah.
Like, it's sure. A sad 30.
30.
As opposed to times where I'm like mad and I'm like 30.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I sure. guess this is 30. So I feel exhausted.
Yeah. Cool.
But it is time for us to move along
cool.
to...
Cool, you're exhausted. Yeah, we're like in the space. We're like in the zone of Ben and Mickey.
We're in the zone of Ben and Mickey, yes, we are. So yes, that concludes the scoring of the different tools. And we're going to move along to our next category titled Creatively. Yes or no?
Ooh.
Would this movie be better with Kevin Costner in it?
You know, I'm not sure that Kevin Costner really fits the vibe here. You'd need to make, like, a whole other character for him, I think. Or, I don't know. Or it could be too distracting, because, like, what's Kevin Costner doing in a $6,000 film? But I don't know. I think I'm a no. But I feel like you're giving me eyes like you might have, like, a slightly different answer. And I'm curious.
So... I'm not going to overthink this. We haven't previously wondered whether or not Kevin Costner would fit within the budget of a film.
True.
So just literally, would this movie be better with Kevin Costner in it? Yes, I think it would be. And this is a film where I would embrace either a young Kevin Costner as Mickey or as Jerry. And I think for this movie... it would be appropriately messed up for Kevin Costner to not be one of the baseball roles. You'd be like, Kevin Costner is in this movie, but he's not even one of the baseball players. The zombie apocalypse sucks.
So, okay. I like that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Does this movie reference Babe Ruth?
It most definitely does not. The only even possible player reference of any kind comes actually in the credits, where as a part of the cast... there is the credit Henry Owens the Worm given to the worm on the hook. This worm, I believe, was named after the pitcher that the Boston Red Sox picked up in the first round of the 2011 draft. Only made 5 starts in the majors, but he is still kicking around and currently in his 3rd season of independent league play, most recently with the Lexington Legends.
Nice deep dive.
But thank you. But
I really admire it.
No Babe Ruth.
No Babe Ruth. Is there a dog?
There is no
Not
dog.
Anymore.
There's a story about having to kill and eat a dog when they were stranded for 3 months in the house in Pittsfield. But as we do not see a dog, I think we have to lean on precedent and say, nope, there is no dog.
Yeah, and I am grateful for it in this case, because I don't want to see the dog that was purportedly killed and eaten in the past.
Yeah.
Eric and I had watched The Babadook the night before this, and I couldn't handle seeing any more dog violence.
Yeah. It's rare that I can get this one over here to watch The Spookies, and so...
I'm doing it for homework.
Yeah.
I'm doing it for homework, people.
It's true. It's true. Just you wait and see, folks.
So, are Yankees fans the main antagonist of this film?
Not directly, although I guess if they are playing for a team, minor league or independent or whatever, that's in Massachusetts, probably they are not Yankee-friendly folks. And so I guess you could do like a kind of there.
Yeah, I had the same thought. Also, this was shot in Connecticut, which... you know, is sort of the dividing line for Yankees fans and Red Sox fans.
It's the fault line, yeah.
Maybe some of those zombies used to be Yankees fans.
Yeah, especially the ones that surrounded the car.
Yeah, the resemblance was so strong. Is there a 6 degrees of baseball?
Folks, this is the first time where not a thing came up. I clicked on every single profile of every single project that people had done. And as far as I could tell, nothing. I mean, maybe baseball is referenced in some of the other things that somebody has worked on. But this is the very first time that I could not find a single baseball connection. And yeah, maybe.
I mean, it's not helped by the fact that there are 6 people in this movie.
It's true. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that, like, we could find a way to connect somebody to a baseball movie, but I'm not sure that that'd be, like, especially interesting or worth it for anybody. And so I'll just say that this is a standalone little miracle.
It's a little island.
Yeah.
It's a baseball movie island. What about a favorite moment for you?
There is so much to choose from here. I think that I'm ultimately going to go with the standoff with Jerry sequence. I think that it is so well done. So they come across a car and are about to siphon some gas from it, and this guy comes out of nowhere and takes Mickey hostage with a knife, and there is a sort of negotiation that takes place where Jerry wants their car. Jerry's the guy's name. He wants to get back to his family. It's all very tense. There's a lot of like variety, and it's one of the main moments in the film, I think, where it's like, oh man, like things are really, really intense right now. Like this is one of those moments in this like zombie world where we are seeing like a real and immediate danger. And I think that the acting is really good. I think that the guy who plays Jerry, who you referenced earlier, I think is wonderful. And I think I'm just going to go with that.
Yeah, I feel like the difference between your favorite moment and my favorite moment is very illustrative of our general taste in genres of movies, because you picked one of the more intense moments and I picked one of the most escapist moments, which is the montage of them playing baseball with apples.
Oh, but that's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great. And like how satisfying to see all those apples explode.
It's so satisfying. It's so, so satisfying. And I particularly love when Mickey gives a nod before lobbing an apple as if he's heard what pitch to throw.
Yeah.
It's really,
really, really,
really
nice
delightful.
Little detail for sure.
I also really did love the toothbrushing scene.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Me too. No, I feel like it would be very easy for me to come up with like half a dozen like, oh, but then there's this and there's this and there's this. I really love this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The montage when they're drunk in the car.
Solid.
Is really good.
Yeah.
It's really great. What about a least favorite moment?
This is maybe a little darker. I don't know. But like, I didn't like seeing Ben escape from the car.
Whoa.
I'm not saying that he shouldn't. I'm not saying that he shouldn't, but I wanted him to make the same speech. And we even see the moment where the lights are on and we see him like exiting out the other way. But I think I wanted that to be ambiguous. I think I wanted there to be a question of whether or not he actually made it, rather than just like telling us like, oh, he made it, and now he's just like going off in search of them. I know that there have been some plans to do a sequel at some point that I think was like sort of working title was like The Orchard, where he like actually goes in search of the people. I don't know if those plans are still in existence, but I don't know. In my opinion, you just, if you do a sequel, you start the sequel with the moment of him escaping or having a flashback there. Probably, hopefully, you have a bigger budget and you can like have more zombies outside of the car, which is like what they wanted anyway. And then you can like deal with that then. But I'm a fan of ambiguous endings, and I just kind of wanted this to have an ambiguous ending.
Yeah, I understand that. I also like ambiguous endings, but I feel like there's a lot of ambiguity even in him getting out of the car.
Sure.
Because he's been shot in the leg. And he can outwalk zombies, but for how long?
That's fair. Yeah.
It was definitely a question in my mind.
What's yours?
So, it's basically when they're in the car and Mickey goes to get the keys, not as a moment, but it was an avalanche of questions for me that were not satisfactorily answered.
Okay.
Like, why doesn't he bring the bat with him or the gun? It didn't make sense to me why they thought it was going to work. Like, I couldn't see a scenario in which realistically he was going to be able to go out and find the keys and somehow avoid all of the zombies.
Yeah.
They were going to see him when he came out of the car, and he didn't bring anything to combat them with. And so I guess
they'd been drinking a lot, so they didn't have their heads straight.
Well, it was the next day. They were sober. But like, if he'd gone out with a weapon, it would have felt eminently more plausible as a plan that they even thought could work.
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite clear on what would have been the spatial relationship with him getting out of the car, going to try to find the keys and get back, that would have culminated in him getting bit on the hand?
Yeah, I don't know. He's a pitcher.
It just felt like the leg or the arm would make more sense.
Yeah, I don't know. He's pushing people away.
Maybe. Okay.
You know. Yeah. I don't know. That didn't bother me that much, but I do totally agree with the like not having a weapon, not having a little bit more of a plan in this plan.
Yeah, I almost in that moment was like, I don't understand what's going on what they think that are going to accomplish. So, scene you would like to see?
I don't know. Maybe a scene on a baseball diamond or in like some kind of like post-apocalyptic stadium. Mm-hmm. There's maybe like budget reasons for all of that and so on and so forth. But in a perfect world, I would like to see like them doing some of their baseball stuff in some kind of proper baseball setting, even if it's like a little league field that's just had several months of growth on it. I totally understand why that did not happen and could not happen. But if we're talking like dreams, that is something I would have loved to have seen.
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. Again, yes, logistically hard for $6,000.
Yeah.
So for me, round about the toothbrush scene, when I was thinking about their need for fresh water and there being no plumbing, I realized Mickey's facial hair. It's not a beard. It's specifically manicured. He shaves part of his face. That's a choice. So I would like a scene in which it is explained that Mickey is shaving. Like, maybe it's even a point of conflict that he's using water to shave. And I realize that this might have sort of been an issue for continuity, for the car scene. But it was a situation where his facial hair seemed like a strange choice for the world that they were in.
Okay.
And I don't know, maybe that's how the character's facial hair grows, and I'm just ignorant in the way of facial hairs shaving. But it looks like it's being pruned in some way.
Sure, 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 sure.
I wanted an explanation.
Yeah. No. I like that. That makes sense to me. So who's the dreamier of the two?
It's Ben.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, he's more practical and you feel like he would be the better person to be in a zombie apocalypse with.
Yeah, completely agree. And, you know, just seems like more chill also.
Yeah, and he's, plus, you know, not in a zombie apocalypse, he strikes me as a super lovable dude.
For sure.
And then, favorite performance.
Jeremy Gardner.
Jeremy Gardner, it doesn't even really need to be discussed.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
He's great. He's wonderful. He created a great showcase for himself.
Yeah.
Here.
I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
I don't know how he did any of the things that he did, but I'm wildly impressed by them. And that concludes our grading of The Battery.
Yes.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, we would really love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. That's the place to do it. You could rate and review us somewhere else, but like if so, please send us a screenshot of that because we're probably not going to see it. And we would like to thank Typho Fickux.
Is this a person from the Star Wars universe?
I mean, maybe. Yeah, it sort of sounds like it. Yeah, that's my best shot at pronouncing this iTunes name. And they write, "Love it. Loved the League of Their Own episode, one of my favorite movies, and I actually learned quite a bit I didn't know about filming and cast. Love the hosts. Just really enjoyable overall. Check it out."
Oh.
It's so sweet.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that's really, really nice.
It's very nice. And it's also nice to know that like episodes that we did a very long time ago when we feel like we were bad at doing this are still enjoyable to people.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So next time we are going to be talking about...
I think I was going for a drum roll, but it sounded more like a machine gun.
That's not the iconic theme music at all. We're going to be doing The Natural.
The Natural! At long last! I know that many people have been waiting for a long time for us to do it. We're finally doing it!
We're finally doing it, folks!
Yeah.
So if you would like to find us on the internets between now and then, you can find me on Twitter at Ellen_Adair and on Instagram at EllenAdairG or at EllenDrawsBaseball, where you can commission from me a picture of a baseball player or of something else.
And I am at Eric Gildy on both of those things. And I will draw you a zombie Kevin Costner if you want.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to remember that.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, I'll give it a shot. You just got to ask. People are not taking me up on this, but I mean it. I will do it.
I want you to draw a zombie Kevin Costner. Okay. Do I count? Does my request count?
You always count.
Thanks, sweetheart.
Yeah, of course.
And we will talk to you next time on Take Me Into the Ballgame.
Bye, guys. Let me root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out at the old ball.